Bloody Elbow presents Crooklyn's Corner, a hodgepodge of current event topics from the combat sports and entertainment community. Here is your host, Crooklyn, a.k.a. Steffi Haynes.
Hello, and welcome back to the latest episode of Crooklyn's Corner. I'm your host, Steffi Haynes, but most of you know me as Crooklyn. And joining me today is my favorite co-host, my favorite guest, because he's basically a co-host. He comes on this show so very much. John Nash, welcome back. Time to talk money.
Thank you. You can hear that or talk about Kid Nate, which is my other hobby. But no, we'll talk money.
Let's talk money for sure. I guess we'll just jump right in. We see lots of fighters go off and retire, and then they have to come back. And in boxing, we don't see that as much because boxers, especially the high-level ones, the ones that make the headlines, make the news frequently, can generate generational wealth. So I want to know if there are fighters in the MMA atmosphere that are on their way or have already gained generational wealth. Now, you get a bonus if you don't name Conor McGregor, because we know he has generational wealth. But are there others? There used to be a term, Anderson Silva money, but I don't know if that's generational wealth. What about GSP? Can you name any of these people?
Well, first you got to define generational wealth. Typically, I think the more common term, there's two definitions of generated wealth usually thrown around. One is having at least $10 million in assets. The other one, which I think is probably the one I think people think of more, is having about $30 million in assets, because that leaves you the money to live as a top 1% and also guarantee your future generations of your offspring will live in the top 1%. Because they'll have such a vast amount of wealth. So how many fighters can retire with $30 million in assets? Now, it's going to take more than $30 million in income because you have taxes, you have expenses, you go along. You can only save a certain portion. But let's just say, we'll use the cutoff, you have to make at least $30 million in your UFC career. And then whatever you make on the side, because you also don't want to count guys that were very smart, let's say, or lucked out. They bought a house in San Francisco years ago, and then the price just skyrocketed. And they made millions on something they lucked out and bought for a couple hundred thousand. There's a lot of situations where guys can get a lot more wealth, but they had nothing to do. So we'll use a cutoff of like $30 million in revenue and pay that a fighter's earned in the ring. When you look at that, there's very, very, very few MMA fighters in history that have generated what we call generational wealth. You've got your GSP for sure. He will remain unnamed that you said earlier. Yes, he has it. George St. Pierre has probably made enough to have generational wealth. Anderson Silva probably has made as much to hit that mark. Brock Lesnar is probably close in his UFC career, but he's made millions outside of UFC and pro wrestling. So he definitely has generational wealth. I don't think in her career that Ronda Rousey made that much. She made millions, $10-20 million, but she never made up to the $30 million mark, I don't think. Going on the line, there might be a few other guys that might surprise us. Fedor Emelianenko was probably close because his minimum purse, and he's fought so many times for that, was at least $2 million. And he's fought several times. I don't know Tito and Chuck Liddell possibly, but I mean, that's really what you're just naming a few guys. I think there's a few guys currently. John Jones has made over $30 million in his career. I don't know if he's properly saved it, but he's made $30 million.
What about Randy Couture?
I don't think in his career he made $30 million. No, if you look back and you add up all of his fights, he did, but he's got an outside career in acting and other stuff. So he might have generated enough there, but he's never made as a fighter. I don't believe he made. In fact, we can go through what he made. And I'm pretty sure he didn't make 30. Yeah, I know he didn't make 30 million. I don't even think he made 20 million in his entire career. So possibly 20 million. You have to add them all up. So, but to hit that 30 million mark is very rare for most MMA fighters. Guys like Adesanya might hit it if he fights a few more times and as the champion. Same with, Nate Diaz hasn't hit it yet, but if he fights a few more times, he might hit it. So there's guys that are potentially now, especially with the purses for the stars getting larger, but it's a small group of fighters.
Moving forward, now that the ESPN deal has netted both the UFC and ESPN such lucrative results, is there a possibility we see another megastar rise like McGregor, or is the UFC sort of stomping out the need for such pay-per-view magnets?
Well, I don't think they're stomping them out. But they don't really need them. They kind of demonstrated. There's very little leverage a fighter has, and I'm sure we'll talk about Francis Ngannou in the future, but he's a prime example of how little they need to really, you know, work with their stars. You know, Nate Diaz was a star, and they still wouldn't work with him for a long time. They wouldn't bend over for his demands. And Jones is a star. They won't bend over for his demands. So I do think there'll be another Conor McGregor. You know, he's a generational star, but they always pop up in the fight business. The UFC's goal, though, is to make sure he pops up in a UFC contract so they can take advantage of it. But eventually, you know, there was Tito Ortiz and Chuck Liddell were big stars in America because the sport wasn't worldwide yet. And then we got to Brock Lesnar was a massive star. And then Conor McGregor was bigger. And now we have a few other stars, regional, you know, like Khabib. But I think eventually we'll have another Conor McGregor, just like there was Mike Tyson and then, you know, Oscar De La Hoya, then Mayweather. We will someone else will spring up. That's just how it always works out.
But what I meant was, like, the UFC helped Conor McGregor along. They nurtured that relationship. They babied him not really babied him as far as his opponents, but they gave him a lot more promotion than they gave most people. Are we seeing the end of that side of it? I guess that's
no. I still think they still nurture, but usually when they do that, when they develop someone, mm-hmm. they recognize that they're an attraction for a region. They can bring a new territory to them, a new market. So They nurtured Conor McGregor. They work with some of the Chinese athletes. They did a big deal pushing a lot of the Russian Middle Eastern fighters because that's a new region they're exploring. So yeah, they'll develop those. But as soon as that region is developed, they don't really have to push guys there anymore. They don't have to give a leg up. Bisping was given a lot more push than similar fighters in his position in the UFC because they needed someone to be the face of the UK. So, well, I think that sense, yeah, it'll be harder, you know, other fighters that push because they won't need the market. But they do pick a few guys that they see a lot of potential for and who are, and especially those fighters show the sign they're willing to work with the UFC. They're willing to, you know, they're willing to give in to the UFC's demands. Then they're much more likely to push them ahead. But they're definitely, it's basically the business model. I think this is Chad Dundas or Ben Folks, one of those two it's just fights now, seems to be the business model of the UFC. We just throw on fights and you tune in because the UFC just has fights on. And that kind of eliminates the need for stars.
And that's what I was getting to. We mentioned Francis Ngannou just a second ago, and so we're going to go ahead and pivot into that. His situation is a tricky one. Discuss the finer details of contract extensions for champions and why Ngannou not signing a new deal might not even matter in the long run because he's still the champion. And side note, can he give up the belt to get out from under?
Well, the issue with Ngannou is it's a litany of all the complaints we saw in the UFC antitrust case. And it's two primary. The one is the primary focus is this is how they argue the UFC retains talent and key fighters can't leave the UFC. The UFC has contracts that allow them to extend it to such a point that a fighter is basically forced to resign. They cannot get out of the contract. So all those people saying, oh, you know, just fight out your contract and go somewhere else. Well, here's an example of someone. There's other fighters, yes, have fought other contracts, but here's a champion that where he's at his most valuable, where if he can negotiate now, he gets the most money. Here are these things that are preventing him from being able to negotiate when he has his value. And what they're doing is there's two things. One is they're using their tolling provisions. What that is if you can't take a fight, they can add 6 months onto the contract because if they offer you a fight and refuse it, it adds 6 months to the duration of the contract. So Francis Ngannou couldn't accept a fight in June because he had visas. Usually it was impossible to accept it. The UFC offered it. Because he refused, didn't accept it, they can now add 6 months to his contract and extend it out. The other thing is he's on the last fight of his contract. So not only is he waiting longer to fight that last fight in his contract and then be a potentially free agent, because he's the champion, they have a champion clause. And what the champion clause does is if your contract ends while you're the champion, it extends it for one more year or three more fights, whatever comes earlier. The problem is the UFC has that extension provision. So if you turn down a fight, they can add 6 more months. So even though the championship clause says it's only for 1 year, guess what? If they offer you a fight and you turn it down, that adds 6 more months that they get to offer you that fight again. And so the contract can be extended. You still have to go through those. You have to go through and fight 3 fights in the duration they give you, fight those out, then finally you're a free agent. So you're talking about, with the extensions, his last fight was, what, March last year? Mm-hmm. It's possible that to get through that championship clause and be a true free agent, it's theoretically possible that it might not be 1 year or whatever. It might be 2 or 3 years down the line before he can finish all that. If they add the tolling provisions and they continue and they make it harder and harder to fight out the contract. Now, the thing about the championship clause, the question you asked, can he just like vacate the title? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I think the contract, I think it's intentionally written vague because that's something you would have to litigate. And you can only really litigate it when you get to that point where you're vacating it and they're trying to extend the contract. And that's, I think it's written that way because then they force the fighter to go to court to get that decided. And that adds more time and money to the process. And so most fighters don't want to do it. So it might be obvious. Like you, to me, it seems obvious. No one can sit there and say, you're my champion. We're just going to declare you a champion and make you get 3 extra fights because that seems like a violation of the 13th Amendment. Involuntary servitude. You're basically making someone to keep working for you in an industry because you arbitrarily can declare something. You know, you're the one that has it's coercive because it's only one individual can apply this. It doesn't work both ways. So that seems like it'd be a violation of the 13th Amendment, but a court has to decide that. And that means he'd have to go to court and that take time and money. And I think that's the intent of it at the same time. So to answer your question, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows at this point.
George St. Pierre hasn't fought since 2017, but the UFC has managed to put the brakes to a proposed charity boxing match that he wanted to do. How long do they have control over him in that regard? Is there a statute of limitations or anything like that on a contract? Because they're still managing to keep him from doing things.
That's a good question. Before, for the longest time, all the contracts were in perpetuity. If you retired, you're frozen forever. Now, I've noticed something on more recent contracts. I've asked around. In the last few years, after Endeavor took over the UFC, starting sometime in late 2017, 2018, the standard contract, I don't know if this is fully the standard, but several of the contracts I've seen and talked to managers and fighters about has a provision that puts a 5-year maximum to the contract or has a 5-year maximum to retirement. And so the maximum duration you could be frozen out by the UFC now would be 5 years. I don't know if George has that in his contract, but that seems to be the new standard. So if it's in George St. Pierre's contract, that means next year his contract would be up and he'd be a free agent after the next year. So that'd be the maximum. And it'd be interesting to see if all the fighters have them or just some or whatever. But if that's the new standard, that's a big change. Because, I mean, when did Nate Diaz last fight? 2014. Nick Diaz, 2014. Mm-hmm. He was still under contract. It was still frozen when he came back to fight now. So he didn't have that provision in his contract. For 7 years, they froze his contract until he returned just recently to fight Robbie Lawler. So that would be a massive change. I can't confirm it's on all the contracts, but I've at least half a dozen I know it's in. So it looks like it's the new standard. And what's interesting, it seems to have been introduced in the second half of 2017, which conveniently is after the antitrust lawsuit's first class period ends, June 30th, 2017. So my guess would be they implemented it because one of the big accusations in the antitrust lawsuit is these contracts theoretically could go forever. Well, now, after that class period ends, we're introducing contracts that cannot theoretically go forever. They have a 5-year limit, what you see in several state regulations for boxing.
Hmm.
And so, you know, fighters, no one, I'm sure several managers have told their fighters, look, I got you a great deal. We have a 5-year maximum, not telling their fighter. That seems to be in all the new contracts.
Now, more and more fighters are airing their extreme financial woes and problems with contract situations, including Francis Ngannou. He stated in that interview with Ariel earlier in the week that he had to borrow money to stay afloat. Even the Francis Ngannous of the world are having to do that. And this, I believe, was after he became champ. Now, the UFC blames the media for putting that idea in fighters' heads that they're not making enough money. But to my knowledge, the media isn't going around telling these fighters to get on the mic and say this stuff in interviews. Will any of these stories of near destitute and or real destitute scenarios be enough to draw attention from some government institution to make a more fair and just environment?
Well, the Ghana ones, I should clarify some of the stuff because I found it interesting. I don't think it was because he didn't make enough money to live his normal life. Because in this, he became champion in March against Stipe Miocic. So it wasn't impacting him before. What it was, I think, is because his base salary, I think, is like $500,000 a fight. Uh-huh. It's not that he couldn't like afford to live, like, oh, I'm broke. No, he could. He said he couldn't afford training camp.
Right.
Now he's fighting at the top level. He has to be, and he has to have a top camp, because if he doesn't win, guess what? He doesn't get to be champion and doesn't get to try to collect millions. So he has to invest a lot in those training camps. I think what he's saying is he had to borrow money to pay for probably the $100,000 or so he had to spend on training camps. And even though he's making $500,000 a fight, if you're only fighting one time a year after your manager, your agent, your taxes, your living, you can't put $100,000 into a fight camp. At $500,000 a year, you would have to, that's what makes sense. He borrowed money to pay for his fight camps. But I think he makes a point. I am fighting at the elite level. I should be making enough money that I do not have to borrow money to pay for my fight camp. Now with the Aspen Ladd, that's a little different. She's absolutely broke and she's going to main event a UFC event. And when's the last time she fought before that?
It's been a while, but it wasn't Aspen Ladd that said that. It was Norma Dumont.
Norma Dumont. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Sunset Boulevard. Yes. Sorry. My mistake. I don't know how I screwed that up. She's like, I love her name. I don't know when's the last time she fought before that, but that is a bad look. And there's, a lot of fighters struggle. A lot of the fight business is full of people that struggle, but it's especially bad because UFC's make, it just looks really bad when the promoter is raking in hundreds of millions of dollars in profit every year. And that just, I think that's the part that's really bad. If it's a small promoter that's barely making ends meet, you're going, well, it's sad, but that's just the way it works. They can pay what they can pay. But the UFC is walking away with hundreds of millions per year. And so we'll make an impact. The UFC is a niche sport, and the fan base, a few fans care, but I think the majority of fans just want to see people's face punch. And I think the general public looks at it as kind of a low class sport, and the people involved in it are probably low class. So there's a potential, if the media picks up on this, if bigger name fighters raise the awareness, then yes, maybe it's possible that legislation will come down the pipe and, the Congress will look again at the Ali Act or something else and get involved. But my general instinct is that the public just doesn't really care. The majority of the public just doesn't care about fighters. They just don't. I mean, I think there's ways to draw sympathy from them, but what they basically know are these are people that get in a cage and punch each other. To most people, this is just, barely one step above bum fights.
I'm going to give you a question that I didn't put in our outline because it just occurred to me to ask you. Sugar Sean O'Malley has a really smart outlook on the way that his pay works and that he gets paid the same whether he fights a contender or whether he fights a guy outside of the top 15. And he plans to do that until his contract comes up and they can renegotiate it. And I love that idea.
No, I think that's really smart by him. It reminds me of a lot of boxers. Their contracts are written that the tougher your opponent, the bigger the fight, the more you get paid. So you get your base pay, but if you fight for a championship, and you remember there's a lot of titles in boxing, your pay goes up. If you're on the headlining an ESPN card or a Showtime card or Zone, whatever, the pay goes up more. So it's tiered. So there's not, the UFC, you get paid the same no matter who you fight. So it's very smart by O'Malley to do that. The one thing he has over everybody else is he has kind of a fan base and image. And so him fighting, him declining to take a fight doesn't really hurt him because he has some value to the promotion. Another fighter who has, he's not an attraction on his own, is and who's dependent on winning fights and moving up the tier of the rankings, he's at less advantage because he needs to fight better opponents to get noticed by the fans, to get noticed by the promotion, and then eventually negotiate a better payday. So it's slightly different in that regard.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about unions, because we have discussed unions and associations many times and sort of came to the unfortunate conclusion that fighters are selfish creatures by necessity because of the UFC's stranglehold, not only on their own fighters, but the entire market. Is there some other way outside unionization that could make their position more tenable?
Well, I mean, yeah, the whole, you're correct. Unionization, like you said, is not just because the fighters are selfish. They are. I think the Athletic did a poll and like 80% of fighters want a union. The problem is, I don't think a union would be, I've said before, as big a union guy as I am, I don't think they'd be that helpful because how the market's designed. But there is a couple things they could do. I mean, it's up to the fighters, but I mean, an association is very much, I guess people consider it the same as a union, but the one benefit an association has is you do not need the solidarity that you have with a union. The more fighters that were in an association, the better it would be, because if you had a majority of fighters, let's say in the UFC, or a majority of fighters in the major promotions, then they'd have a lot of power. But you could also try to get stuff done with a smaller group of fighters. If you can, instead of having 600 fighters where you need, you know, well, the UFC has what, 600 fighters right now, I believe?
Yeah. Somewhere in that neighborhood.
The former union, you got to get over half of them to vote for a union, which is basically an impossible task the way it's set up. But let's say you got 100 fighters, specifically the bigger, some of the bigger name fighters, that would be an immensely powerful block to get something done. The option too is you're going to have to get, in my opinion, some sort of outside forces acting upon the promotions in MMA, because the fighters themselves will never be able to do it because, like I said, you will never have the solid block of solidarity. So you need something that's going to change the equation. And I think the only couple possibilities, you could argue the antitrust lawsuit, but that's years down the road. We don't know exactly what it's going to do. And the fighters today probably want something. Although, as we said earlier, with the 5-year max that was seems to be introduced into contracts, the antitrust lawsuit has done something. We know more about fighter pay than we ever did before because of that lawsuit. And because of that lawsuit, it looks like the UFC Endeavor, as owners of the UFC, has implemented a 5-year max to their contracts. That's a huge change for where we were a few years ago. But on top of that, the other things I would say is you'd have to get something legislatively passed as a possibility. If you had an association or a large group of fighters showing up in Congress and lobbying and making really with one voice, bringing public awareness to it, it's possible you could get like the Ali Act expanded MMA or a different piece of legislation. That's one possibility. And that would bring outside forces to give fighters leverage to do something. The other possibility is getting some fighters. And the problem is who's going to be the person that steps forward and takes the risk, some fighters to challenge the current contracts, to get precedent set that some of these provisions are not allowed, that they're illegal, and that so they cannot be used. And so they're no longer a cudgel overhanging fighters in negotiations. So that's basically your options.
And the idea that one big star or a couple of big stars could do this is basically smoke and mirrors, because it has to be more, especially now that they have the ESPN deal and they don't have to have that many big pay-per-view stars. They've got this ESPN deal where they could just fill the roster with whoever they want. The Contender Series is a good generator of content, of talent there.
No, yeah, it's the idea that you're going to get, Luke Rockhold said, if the three brothers, the three fighters of African descent who, you know, that are big friends of each other. Kamaru Usman, Francis Ngannou, and Israel Adesanya all banded together. It would change everything. No, it wouldn't. We've seen it. We've seen, you know, Francis Ngannou has his problems and kind of held out, and they don't care. They just mint a new interim belt title. John Jones is sat out. They don't care. They just keep moving on. There was a period where Conor McGregor didn't fight. The UFC, just the machine kept rolling on. So getting a few select top guys not to fight, that doesn't mean anything, because UFC is still going to get their contractual revenue. They can still put on pay-per-views. They'll still, because they have the almost the totality of all the draws in the sport signed to them, they can keep booking big matches, even with big fighters holding out.
Man. You mentioned something that really stuck out to me. I mean, when I saw this on your timeline, I was like, my God, that is awful. But basically what it comes down to is that Joe Silva used to hold fighters hostage to their contracts by offering them fights while they were under commission suspension. Now, I'd like for you to elaborate on that, because you can be suspended by the commission for several different things, for PED use, drug use, but also the commission suspends you after fights if you've been hurt. So I want you to tell me if by commission suspension, would that also apply to, say, you saw suspensions, or is this strictly for the athletic commissions?
Well, USADA suspensions would also be, that's a guarantee, because your contract freezes while you're under USADA suspension. So that's an automatic. What was supposedly happening, the UFC, and a lot of the, you see comments in this, the excerpts from emails and stuff from the antitrust lawsuit, and you also have talked to managers and fighters that said this would happen, is that you'd get an automatic notice after a fight that, you know, that there's an injury, an injury extension. But basically, because you had a suspension, the UFC was saying that during that period of time, you were injured and couldn't accept a fight, and they're going to add that injury time to your contract. Now, for those, I believe it was just the suspension period. So if they said you can't fight or train for 6 weeks or whatever, or 2 months, they'd add the 2 months. But sometimes when looking, they would look for, there's an email where Mike Mercer apparently was just looking for an excuse. Joe Silva said extend him 6 months, and they just looked for an excuse and just made up one to add 6 months to a contract. So a way they can do it is, if you're under athletic commission suspension, apparently they can offer you a fight. You can't take it. I'm suspended. Oh, yeah, you can't take it. We can use that and say, well, add 6 months. Now, there's a lot of people would say that couldn't uphold in the court. And it probably, I don't think that could uphold the court. I don't think you can do that. That seems extremely one-sided. The problem is, what fighter is going to challenge that in a court? And that's where you get the law. A lot of these things obviously seem like practices that would never uphold under any sort of contract law, under any court decision. But if no one can challenge it because they don't want to spend the time and money and tick off the UFC, it basically serves its purpose, which is a chilling effect, or give the UFC the right, these options to do it.
Wow. That just blows my mind. I mean, it just seems absolutely criminal.
Well, yeah, it's not fair. I'll say that much. It's if no one's going to challenge it, that's when we get back to the fighters, unions and associations. That's one thing a collective of an association of fighters could think about. Yeah. Now, no one wants to step forward and challenge UFC, but if you all get together and basically maybe pool your resources and ask someone, and one fighter willing to step forward and, you know, take one for the team, well, maybe the other fighters can reward them. And basically pay him and donate, because an association can do that, you have standing, could pay for the legal challenge. So they're all together. This one guy is going to step up. The association is going to take care of the legal fees, because it's something that affects everybody, so that you're allowed to do that as an association. And that way, all the fighters benefit if he wins that decision. And he's not taking the risk, because he's not holding the burden of paying for the lawyer fees.
That leads me to my next question here. What are your thoughts on this new World Fight League, that a network of former promoters, former NFL players, NBA players, and MMA athletes are putting together? And I want to read something to you. They want to They want to host anywhere between 8 and 24 teams with 24 fighters making up rosters, which includes 3 fighters from each weight class. As of now, 6 owners have been approved, 4 in the U.S. and 2 in Canada. A structure for a collective bargaining association hasn't been made yet, but they are looking to make one. Any approved franchise owner has signed agreements that enforces certain terms and conditions that they must abide by. Some of these provisions are put into place so they will not be able to take more than 50% of the revenue share. Additionally, per sources, they must provide specific levels of health insurance, career-ending insurance, and pension plans for their athletes. When the union is established, the plan is for athletes and owners to finalize negotiations and agreements. And this looks like it's, like they want to set it up for 2023 release. And they've been working on this since last year. So to me, it has seems like it has a combination element from the IFL with the idea of teams. And it also has an element of that. Remember the MMA association thing that George St. Pierre and Cowboy Cerrone and Bjorn Rebney, of all people, and all of those people tried to get together and do, and they quickly abandoned it. So it seems like it's combining both of those elements. Do you see red flags already? Do you think this has any kind of legs under it? Or are we just going to see this thing come and go in a puff of smoke?
Well, until they actually hold an event, I don't know what's really there. What everything sounds nice. Everything sounds like what everybody wants, but I have a lot of questions. One is the IFL tried this, and Team MMA does not seem to have much appeal to fans. So I don't know why this would suddenly work. This would be better than the IFL. It'd have more chance of success. So that's one. Two, the 50% of share of revenue to fighters sounds great, except we don't know what the revenue is. When you're Bellator, if we look at Bellator right now, pays about 50%. When you're a second tier promotion, when you're not challenging, but you're competing against a larger firm, the standard for pay for athletics seems to be around 50%. So they would have to pay 50% anyways just to get fighters. Right. Mm-hmm. So 50% doesn't mean anything when you're talking about a small group of revenue. And it really, so what we depend on goes, what's the TV deal going to be, the broadcast deal, license fee, because that'll determine how much they can really pay. If they get a broadcast deal that pays them $2 million a year, 50% of that's not a lot. So we're not so really they would be depending. If you're gonna have eight teams, you're dependent on getting a TV deal of like $100 million a year to make sure you have enough to sign top fighters, that you pay top fighters enough that you could actually draw fighters that fans would be interested in. But so you're talking about a sum of money, multiples of what the highest paid non-UFC promotion, Bellator, has ever made in the U.S. market. That doesn't seem very likely.
Wow. If somehow we get to see the Ali Act instituted in MMA, give us an idea what that might look like. What would change?
That's a big question, actually. in many ways, very little would change. There's a lot of stuff in it that we know instantly. There's a provision in it that says the promoter has to share compensation with the fighters. Now, a lot of boxing promoters get around this, and they really only share that compensation with the fighters that are used to market the event. In other words, so basically only the fighters that appear on the poster and marketing would the promoter have to share compensation information in. But still, that's a lot more than what we see currently with MMA. So there's that. There's the firewall between promoters and managers. There's also a lot of state regulations that have that. So I don't know if that would be that big a change. The massive change in the Ali Act would come from two provisions and how they get interpreted. The major one would be, would the courts interpret the Ali Act as saying that that promoters and sanctioning organizations cannot have to have some sort of separation, that you cannot compensate, a promoter cannot compensate a sanctioning organization, Would the court look at that and say promoters in MMA can't have their own titles? It doesn't directly say that, the LA Act. You read it, it doesn't say that a promoter can't have their own title. But I've talked to a lot of people, and they think because you can use the rest of the summary and the intro and all the other parts of the bill to get the intent of what the courts are saying, what the writers were saying of the bill. And the intent seems to be that the promoters can't have control over the titles. So the big question would be, someone would have to challenge it right away. If someone challenged it, does the court say that the promoter cannot have the title? If the promoter can't have the title, that's huge, because no longer then can a promoter say only people that sign with me can fight for this title, right? A third party would have to handle the titles. So I guess the question would be, would the UFC, Bellator just stop having champions? I mean, there's some hint that the UFC seems to have, like, they're trying to have a leeway. They always say this, that our titles are ceremonial. They're not actual titles. It's just for, as Epstein supposedly told Mark Wayne Mullen, our titles are just for the best fighter of the night. Would they do what they did with the BMF title and just have a new title every time there's a fight and get rid of the lineal championships they kind of have now? That's a possibility. But the UFC might say, you know what? The fans demand champions. And so we have to start using a sanctioning organization or some sort of third party that handles the titles. So that'd be a massive, because if the promoters can't control the ranking and title, fighters gain tremendous leverage, because no longer can the promoter say, you don't get to fight for the title because you're asking for it too much. We're going to go to this guy. No, instead, the sanctioning organization says that guy's the number one mandatory. He gets to fight for the title. And if you want to put on the event, you have to negotiate with that guy. Otherwise, we're going to go to purse bid, and you know the amount of money just skyrockets for those people involved. So that'd be one. The second one would, if that happens, the coercive contracts become an issue, because in the Ali Act, a coercive contract is one where, as a promoter, I can't tell a boxer, "Hey, you want to fight my fighter who's the champion? You have to sign with me for 2 years, four or five fights, whatever." You could do that in MMA. You know, that's what happens in all promotions. You don't get to fight, you don't get to fight Kamaru Usman if you're a welterweight unless you sign with me long-term in the UFC. But under the Ali Act, if someone says, I want to fight, I'm a top-ranked fighter, I guess lightweight's better. If Eddie Alvarez says, I want to come to UFC a few years ago and I want to fight the lightweight champion or Chandler, and they go, okay, you can fight the champion, and I can't force you to sign a long-term contract. I can force you to sign as a one-year deal. And if you're a mandatory, if the sanctioning organization declares that guy a mandatory, I can't demand any options. That guy can come in, fight the champion, win, and then leave the promotion, and I have no rights to him at all. So that's a huge game changer, both of those. That would radically change things, except for the fact the UFC is so big, has so much money, they could easily guarantee themselves that they're going to put on all the big fights by just outbidding everybody. So the big change would be probably that the UFC wouldn't lose all the big fights and wouldn't lose all the big fighters. The big change would probably be that the UFC would just have to start paying a lot more.
Wow. All right. So I need to ask you, are there any updates on the antitrust suit? Has any new documentation been revealed? Anything at all that you can reveal to us?
Nothing new specifically the antitrust lawsuit. There was a paper that was filed, which was a rebuttal to a Paul Gift paper about MRP, marginal revenue product, for that about pay-per-views, how much fighters generate on pay-per-view, what their MRP is in the UFC. And some associates of Hal Singer, the economic expert in the UFC antitrust lawsuit, some associates of Ted Tatos, and some other guys, Ted Tatos does really good work on the economics, sports economics, they challenged and confronted some of Paul Giff's assumptions in his paper. And so that was the big thing, although it has really very little to do with the it has a little bit to do with the antitrust lawsuit, because it's possible someone cites Paul Giff's paper in it, but it didn't have anything specifically to do with it.
Okay. My final question is a little off topic, but sort of still there. Dana White said that Fury Wilder 3 was what boxing needed, and he sort of implied that boxing is somehow in the toilet and that they needed that to be revived. What is the actual health of boxing like right now? Is there trouble on the horizon, or is Dana sort of spinning his wheels to make the UFC look better?
I mean, boxing is a little trouble right now. I think anybody that's a fair observer would say there's some trouble because the pandemic made it very hard for them to put on big fights, because a lot of boxers get a cut of the gate and stuff. They didn't want to fight without the gates because their purses went down and they didn't want to accept a smaller purse, and a bunch of other issues stepped in the way that we didn't get some of the big fights the last 2 years that we'd kind of hoped for. It's also hurt their ratings, and because of the problems that DAZN and others made in making big fights, they're basically going to leave the off the air in America. Their DAZN USA or Matchroom USA seems to be dead on arrival. So that takes a player off the market in the USA. So there's some problems we see there. But overall, I mean, going forward, there seems like there's going to be a string of big fights coming up, and big fights could easily turn it around. It quickly could become, we might forget about this lull and these problems in no time, because we got, you know, we just had a Fury Wilder, which didn't sell gangbusters like some people hoped, I guess, but it did good. The only problem is they paid him a lot, so the promoters probably lost money on it. But we got Canelo, Caleb Plant coming up. I bet you that sells pretty good. We got Crawford Porter coming up. I don't know how much it'll sell coming so close after Canelo Plant, but it's a very interesting fight. So there's a lot of good fights coming up. Joshua Usyk early next year. So there's a lot of big, interesting fights. So I think the potential for boxing to recapture the public's interest is there, because it was a bad, the pandemic led to a period of just kind of bad fights being made.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And what I want to do right now is give you the floor so you can let us know what you've got coming up, because you've been releasing videos and shows and articles. I mean, you just have been a busy, busy bee. So tell us exactly what we can look for out there.
Well, I should have something on Francis Ngannou and how his contract works with the UFC and the extension. I have a couple videos I hope to come out in the next week or two. I think they're basically done, but I'm trying to get some stuff done on them. I'm kind of a lazy person, so that's a problem there. And then I have there's no victory lap tomorrow on or I guess whenever this comes out on the last Care Don't Care, because there was no cares. So I guess the next time I care, I can take a victory lap. And then if the shoe fits, I do every other week, filling in for Nate Wilcox, 3-time Legion of Doom.
And we'll probably have something else with you coming out in the very near future with me besides this episode. So on that bright and shiny note, we're going to wrap up the show. So until next time, folks, please stay safe.
Thank you for listening to this Bloody Elbow Presents production. To check out more of our content, hop over to the Bloody Elbow Presents SoundCloud and iTunes pages, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is also titled Bloody Elbow Presents. We're also on Apple TV, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Player FM, and Amazon Music. Just search for Bloody Elbow Presents, and you'll get brand new shows throughout the week, including Care Don't Care, The Mookie and Crookie Show, the best of the Come On Now MMA podcast, Crooklyn's Corner, the MMA Vivisection, the Level Change podcast, Show Money, the 6th Round Post Fight Show, 6th Round Retro, the MMA Depressed Us, and radio style play by play for every UFC pay per view. You can also follow us on Twitter at Bloody Elbow and on Facebook at facebook.com/Bloody Elbow Blog, and of course on BloodyElbow.com.